Let's just say we no longer bat for the same team.
What team is that? The Pittsburgh Poon Chasers?
Still Queer as Folk.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast, where each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 15 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Please click that subscribe button so you don't miss any of our episodes. And if you like our show, 5-star ratings really make us happy.
And make sure you continue the discussion with us on all the social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can find us on Facebook at Still Queer as Folk and Twitter and Instagram at Still Queer AF.
This episode is called Big Fucking Mouth. It's episode 9 of season 3.
It first aired in the U.S. on May 11th, 2003.
Big Fucking Mouth, I like saying that, was directed by Kelly Macon, who last directed episode 5. There's nothing noble about being poor.
Let's find all the ways we can say big fucking mouth for the end of the episode.
Big fucking mouth.
Big fucking mouth.
BFM.
BFM. It sounds like the sequel to the BFG, the Big Friendly Giant. Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman, executive producers, wrote the story, and Del Shores wrote the teleplay, his second episode as a writer. He produced 41 episodes of the show, about half the series, and wrote 8 episodes.
From Queer as Folk, the book, here's what happened in Big Fucking Mouth.
Ted is in a jobless rut and can't even get work at the Big Q.
Brian and Justin return to their original agreement of a relationship.
All quotes there. Melanie starts cutting back at work, but doesn't like when work starts cutting back on her.
Stockwell fires Brian for being gay, then rehires him for the same reason when the polls start to dip.
Debbie gets to work against the politician and ends up losing Horvath.
Justin designs a racy cover for the second issue of Rage. Huh. So, Big Fucking Mouth has an average IMDb rating of 8.4. That's about right in the middle of the road for this season. But right off the bat, this episode started to annoy the hell out of me.
Even with that high IMDb rating?
Yeah. It's the same old tired story of Michael being jealous of Brian and Justin.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's like more snide remarks from Michael in the comic store when Justin shows him the pornographic Rage cover. It's like, enough already.
The first note I literally have for this episode is Brian and Justin together again at Babylon and Michael looking sulky again.
Yes.
He's like, he's like the villain who has been thwarted.
Over and over and over. It's like, enough. We understand this story.
We've said it so many times. Get the fuck over it.
I've now transgressed all of this anger from Michael onto the writing staff because they keep doing this.
Damn you, Del Shores.
And Cohen and Lipman.
Especially Cohen and Lipman, I'm sure.
The good news is that eventually I believe that Michael mostly gets over this, but I think we're like a long ways away from that.
You would think after having a hot man like Ben, Michael would somehow allow himself to let go.
Yeah.
Because so, I'm sorry, but in terms of attractiveness, if we're going to do a comparison, I'm over here in the Ben camp.
Well, following along with this little annoying intro is I super disliked Justin telling Michael that he was right about Brian showing Justin that he loved him every single day. They just retroactively erased Ethan.
That's what this show does. When they introduce a character that they decide that our leads are not going to be in love with for the rest of the season, we're going to just pretend like they don't exist.
Yeah, and it's like the writing team was trying to convince us of something that didn't happen. It's fake news.
Lies and vicious rumors.
So this episode was kind of all over the place, and I had a hell of a time trying to pick out the A story and the B story.
No, at this point, it's sort of a mishmash, and we just are going to have to hop back and forth, I think.
It was sort of like a patchwork quilt where your grandmother takes all the assorted rags and disused clothing, cuts them into squares, and makes a quilt out of them.
A somewhat ugly quilt, but it gets the job done.
Yeah, yeah. And it has sentimental value to it. But here, it was just all these disconnected and disjointed storylines. So the closest I got was Brian and Stockwell versus the community for the A story.
Which at that point bleeds into the Debbie and Horvath sort of B story. And that ad that they're shooting for Stockwell with his own kids is such an interesting juxtaposition to what we saw just prior, which is Brian and Justin going into the back room as they were to do when they were together. But now Justin is a little weary about going in there because there are these rumors that there may be undercover cops in the bars now. So they can't really act as they once did.
One of the most important lessons I ever learned is, if you say it, mean it. Right, boys?
Right, Dad.
When I say I'm going to make Pittsburgh family friendly once more, you can be sure I mean it.
I did like how the kids were very, yes, Dad.
It was so Leave It to Beaver. Yes, Father. No, Father. Almost Stepford Wivesy.
Well, yeah, I was almost like, John Jr., blink three times if you're being held against your will.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, exactly. Especially when, you know, your father's like the police chief. That's terrifying.
Something I picked up that was kind of a bright spot in this episode was we see John Stockwell Jr., the baby Stockwell.
Yes.
He's played by Keir Gilchrist, and this was his first acting gig. He's been working steadily ever since. He's probably best known for his work on The United States of Tara.
Which I really like that series. If you've never watched it, I'm a big fan of it.
He was in every episode of it. And lately he's been on Atypical. And when I saw him in the show, there's just a couple of fleeting moments. I thought I recognized him, but I just couldn't place him until I looked at the credits. And I was like, hey, that's that guy. And then I spent another like 2 hours thinking, what guy? I knew I recognized him. So then I finally pulled up the credits and saw that he's in The United States of Terror. It's like, aha. He's very young then, so we can be forgiven. This hot tub scene was a little weird. Did you think that Stockwell was about to come out to Brian when he's this big buildup? There's something I got to tell you that I've never told anyone else, not even my wife.
Yes, absolutely. I thought he was like, by the way, I suck all the dick in the bathhouse. It was like the homoeroticism of that whole thing was very strong. Because weren't they naked?
They were. And do straight guys really jump into their home hot tub naked with each other? Is that a thing?
I think they do, but they're usually about 5 feet apart to show that they're not gay.
Oh, I thought it was weird.
Oh, it was absolutely weird. It's like,
bro, turn around while I get in the hot tub.
It's like, and there's all these references to Brian's balls, and they're like, I'm glad you noticed. Like, what is going on? But this is all to build up that Stockwell is just admitting that he's scared of winning the election.
What are you running for then, pal? Right?
This is, it's oddly Trumpian in a way, because there's been so many think pieces about whether or not Trump actually wanted to be president. And he just wanted to see if he could win. Well, he won. And now look at where we are. We're in absolute shambles because this fucking idiot got elected.
This story was just so strange. It picked up steam when Brian is caught in a bar, in a gay bar.
At Woody's.
Yeah. And I guess that was something that used to be a thing where if you were just seen going to the gay bar, you were pegged as gay. But nowadays, there's like more straight people at some gay bars.
The amount of bachelorette parties that go to gay bars is just insane nowadays. It's almost the novelty now rather than being that secret safe place for gays to go. Everything's so much more mainstream.
I recall about the time that the show was airing, the city of Chicago enacted an ordinance for the late night bars. So in Chicago, certain bars that hold certain license can stay open until 4 a.m. on a Friday night and 5 a.m. on a Saturday night. And there was a push to get rid of all those, to have all the bars in the city closed down at 2 o'clock. One of the compromises was, okay, the 4 and 5 o'clock licenses can stay open, but they have to have surveillance video at all the entrances to the bars. Of course, the gay bar owners were like, whoa, wait a minute. We can't film people coming in here. It's like they will be outed. You think about it now, though, and I don't know if it's just a matter of CCTV being everywhere, that people are just accustomed to being videotaped wherever they are, or whether just nobody cares if you're gay and or if you're going to a gay bar more specifically.
I mean, it's still a fear for some people, but it's more easily explained away. Because as you said, we see all types of people going to gay bars now. It's not just an exclusively queer establishment. we see a lot of different kinds of people now because we try to be more welcoming.
Yeah, I mean, the mere presence of you being at a bar doesn't mean anything.
Exactly. Now, you blowing someone in the bathroom stall says something otherwise.
I didn't do that. That was on the dance floor. No, wait, that was you on the dance floor.
Yes.
You blew, I jerked. Other people.
Other people, not each other. Yeah. No.
So let's talk about the strip show that Debbie was hosting.
Yes, it was called Tease for Teens.
Tease. Oh, I get it. A-Tease.
Tease, okay. Yeah. Tease for Teens.
I loved how Uncle Vic was in the crowd, like totally loving the show.
Damn right he was. It made me wonder where Rodney was, but.
Debbie grabbed that guy's dick also.
Well, he sort of guided her hand there.
That's true, but Sharon Gless touched it.
She touched it. Yes, she touched it. And then made a joke about it, which I'm surprised they didn't think about this more often. Like, yeah, let's get Debbie from the diner to be the host. She's right, a hoot and a half.
The shutdown of the bar seemed pretty unrealistic to me. It's like two Plankos cops just happened to be there. And like, oh, we see Dick. They pull out the badges, hold them up. We're closed. Everybody out.
Everybody, listen up. Pittsburgh PD. This establishment is now closed for violation of section 493, subsection 10, lewd and immoral behavior.
What the fuck? We're just stripping for charity here.
Yeah, look, I want everybody to clear out the front. Come on, let's go. Let's go. Come on, let's go.
Poor Matthew, exposing himself.
Was that his name?
That was the name of that stripper at that point. In Joe Boxer Briefs? How dare
is
you?
Is that what he had on?
That is clear as day. And all I could think was, how dare you?
I thought that for everything that Brian was making out of getting that guy to show his dick, there wasn't much of a payoff.
And especially when he saw it earlier. Not 2 seconds ago,
because yeah.
He said, "I'll pay you." I think what I'll pay you $100 if you show your dick. And so he just pulled his pants, and I was like, "Yeah, right there, there you go."
Ta-da.
And he's like, "No, up there." And then I was like, "Wait, did he see it?" And then think, "Oh, it'll be a cruel joke to get him to do it."
Yeah,
I didn't understand.
Yeah, it's like Brian doesn't have to pay people $100 to see dicks anyway. He gets it for free
all the time.
So Stockwell fires Brian.
Then why? At this critical juncture, are you firing me?
Let's just say we no longer bat for the same team.
What team is that? The Pittsburgh Poon Chasers?
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm talking about pussy, Jim. Look, don't insult me. One of your posse saw me at Woody's last night and reported back.
You should have told me.
Well, my rule has always been, if I'm not sucking your cock, then it's none of your fucking business.
I do like Brian's mantra of his sexuality always being his own business unless he's having sex with somebody. I like that because it seems like that's the first thing out of a lot of guys' mouths these days. Hi, I'm Troy. I'm gay. It seems to like come up like very quickly in a lot of cases. Like they just can't wait to let you know.
Yeah.
And I like Brian's approach where it's just, unless we're hooking up, yeah. Why does this matter?
Unless my dick is actually in
your butt.
Mouth.
Butt.
Or butt.
I mean, he said, yeah. I would go with butt in this case.
You would say butt, yes.
It's easy to suck off a straight guy. A
little That's harder to fuck true, him. Yes.
In this case, I do think that Brian had a duty to tell Stockwell before running his campaign, though. Because in politics, everything matters, especially something like this, where it could materially impact the boss.
Well, do you think that's more on Brian or that's more on Stockwell for not vetting the guy?
We can probably put it on Stockwell in this case because we don't like him and he's the bad guy. But
that's very true. Yes.
Usually when you're joining a campaign or something like that, you are vetted and you are asked, is there anything about you or your past or your associates that could be embarrassing to the candidate?
All they would have to do is literally go turn the corner on Liberty Avenue and say, Brian Kenny. And I'm pretty sure half the neighborhood would be like, listen.
Yeah. We know a little bit about this guy.
He's the Brian Kenny.
This story jumps around a little bit and we'll get to Debbie hollering and screaming about it in the B story. This is a moment where the story started to fall apart, which is after the drubbing at the bar, Brian mysteriously goes back to help Stockwell. That part didn't make sense. After everybody's yelling at him, No, it wasn't at the bar. It was at the diner where like the entire group of people.
Yes. There's basically him. The grassroots rally that Debbie has gotten. And she's calling Brian out on him turning his back on the community.
The entire future of Liberty Avenue is being threatened. And your best friend here not only doesn't give a shit, he's also helping to make it happen.
Yeah. Can I get some lunch? I'm going to be late for my prayer group.
I'm not serving today. I got other things to do. And why don't you do the right thing for once and come with us?
Come on, Ma, leave him alone. Brian didn't cause the raid.
I'm sorry, Michael, but Debbie's right. Brian has played a big part in encouraging Stockwell to target the gay community.
Stockwell's never once mentioned them.
Us!
But he has implied it in every word he's spoken.
Michael, whose side are you on? Your friends, your families, your communities, or his?
So after seeing that, though, why would Brian go back to Stockwell? This whole story stopped making any kind of logic.
Stockwell then has the nerve in his press conference, and I'm sure this was Brian's suggestion.
Yeah, the I have gay friends.
Yes,
defense.
My campaign so happens to be people. Run. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? You're actually playing the gay card here?
As for being homophobic, I feel these charges were made for the sole purpose of damaging my reputation and my campaign for mayor. I hold no animosity whatsoever towards our law-abiding gay citizens, many of whom support my efforts to eliminate drugs, prostitution, and businesses that profit from illicit sex. In fact, the person in charge of my entire advertising campaign, a close friend and personal advisor, happens to be gay.
And then the camera cut back to Brian, and I couldn't tell if he was thinking, oh my God, I've made a huge mistake, or this should help him, or I was trying to understand what the conflict was in Brian's face in that moment.
I wanted him to be worried about what he had just done, but this writing is just so haphazard and amateur that it's hard to tell. It might not have even been in the story. The only thing I liked about this scene was that it was snowing.
Oh yeah, it's winter in Pittsburgh.
Because that must have been one hell of a shoot, though, and it probably wasn't on purpose, but it added this nice grit to the scene that I really liked.
Yeah, seeing their breath in the cold, and
I mean, I can get next to this story if Brian was always making it about money, but here it seems like he only wants to win at any cost. At this point, after everybody's ganged up on him in the bar, he's like, "Yeah, I need to win." And there's only one kind of motivation for that type of behavior, and that's this bizarre internal drive to win no matter what and no matter who gets in your way.
Yeah, especially when I thought after he got fired, all I could think was like, oh, now he cares.
Yep, exactly. And then he goes right back to it.
I mean, that's like, it's such an eternal white gay syndrome. A white gay syndrome. He doesn't... Because and
what
Brian,
is that?
Brian was always upfront in that he could care less about politics, in that as long as I'm not affected, I don't care. Well, now he's affected, so now I'm going to speak up. It's the same shit with like Caitlyn Jenner now saying that she disagrees for supporting Trump. It's like, no, you made that bed, and now you're going to lie in it.
Well, I mean, with Brian, it was he was in it to make money. Going back to that first event with the Periscope with Gardner.
Oh, yes. When he was eyeing his target.
Yeah, I don't understand the story too well. As a whole, it's one of those stories that you think about as a whole and you're like, yeah, that was a good story. But when you're taking it apart episode by episode, it just doesn't hold up at all. It doesn't make any sense.
You don't understand A to B to C.
Yeah, why is he doing it?
At this point, it's A to D to Z to F to M to what the hell?
There's this, what I call a totally random sex scene at the end of the episode. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was great eye candy, but it didn't really tie anything together for me. I don't know why that was there. Liked watching it, but.
Yeah, so we see Justin's controversial cover of Rage, of JT blowing Rage, and then to Justin blowing Brian. And sure, yeah, he's blowing him. It looks good. Speaking of good.
But what did this mean? Why was this here?
I don't know.
The story of Rage and JT and the symbolism of that. Is this...
Was Justin's blowjob the one who's supposed to somehow melt Brian's icy heart? But like, I think that's where it's supposed to go. But it doesn't get there.
Well, I wonder if this was Dahl Shores' attempt to have fantasy show reality with them. Like, Justin won, he got his cover, and he also got the dick back in his mouth. I don't know.
I don't have an answer.
Was it just to show that even though Brian is lending his name to Stockwell's crusade against the gay people, that he's still a big queer? I don't know.
I don't know. The only thing I really enjoyed out of this scene was there's a knock at the door. There's a knock at the door. And Brian says, that's my 11 o'clock. And I thought, oh, he's just being funny. But no, he actually has a trick coming over.
Yeah. And again, what for?
Only to let Justin say the shadiest fucking thing I've ever heard out of his mouth.
Who's he? Oh, that's a difficult question to answer given the limitations of the language, the conventionality of most people's thinking. Let's just say he's the guy I fucked more than once. Unlike you.
Recycled story, by the way.
Yes.
Well, I guess this scene maybe then was just to show us that Brian and Justin returned to their previous arrangement.
Yes. All I know is that was how you just wrote shady bitch. There's and I love the fact that the trick stayed, like knowing this information.
Well, of course, he's a trick. He's not there to get married.
He just seemed so offended when he saw another man there.
We've seen that story many, many times with tricks that come over and run into Justin there. So stop recycling, guys. The only thing nice about this scene was a great prop moment where we see this big gallon jug-sized thing of lube in the background of Brian's bedroom. And it even had like one of those hand pump dispensers on the top, so you can just reach over and go, get a handful and off you go.
That description makes it sound like it's a keg.
It was big. It was huge. It looked like a gallon jug.
Still queer as folk.
Like what you hear? Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. We like those 5 stars.
Still queer as folk. There's more on the way. Let's talk about some of the fun stuff here with Debbie and Horvath.
Yes.
There was something.
Have a bath.
There was something in this diner scene where Horvath is about to get poisoned that I didn't like. And it was this weird little bit of trans humor with Kiki and Kenny.
Kiki, the new waitress, formerly Kenny, the old waiter, is the mistress of ceremonies. I hear she's so funny, you're going to bust a gut.
Oh, fuck.
Kenny? Kiki, what's the matter?
I just had the pink plate special.
It seemed like Debbie was making a joke of it. Then when we see Kiki, she seems to be a trans caricature, not like a normal trans person.
It was Kiki.
So I just didn't like some of this humor that was there.
See, now I feel like I didn't pay attention because I totally just chalked it up to Kiki being a drag queen.
Well, it was Kiki, the waitress, and Kenny, formerly known as Kenny, the waiter. And then Debbie's confusing her name once, and Kiki looked more like a Kenny there. So it just didn't seem like very good treatment of what I believed to be a transgender person.
Well, and Lord knows this series does not have a great track record in treating anyone other than the gay white male in an appropriate manner.
Greg Campbell played Kiki and Kenny, and that character actually appears in 3 episodes, including the series finale.
Wow.
I don't remember what happened to Kiki / Kenny.
That's the thing. All the times we've been in this diner, I've only ever seen Debbie and Justin working there.
Sometimes there's like a cook in the kitchen that you
get. Well, and sometimes that cook was Vic.
One time it was Vic.
Sometimes
you get a glimpse of the cook, and occasionally there's somebody else, like the one that served the pink plate special of the 12-inch wieners.
Yeah.
That was somebody special. Did a walk on there. I did like the humor, though, of Debbie's bionic dash to save Horvath from the pink plate special.
I thought it was so out of place.
It was a comedy moment, almost like Debbie was the bionic woman who can run like super fast and she takes that dive to save Horvath.
I get that, but there was no other moment in this episode where that kind of stylized humor happened.
I'll bring you a burger.
So I just felt like, well, you just did that to do it, didn't you?
Yeah.
But I'm glad she, like, she managed. I thought she was going to, like, smack the fork out of his hand or something, but she just managed to just
throw it to the ground.
She just grabbed it.
Something that I thought was weird. Well, not weird. Something I thought maybe Debbie overreacted to was one bar being closed down one night because they, you know, technically were breaking the law.
I get where her anger is coming from.
She went nuclear.
Well, yeah, because they were doing something for charity. They
still illegal, though.
I mean, is it really illegal? What are, like, I guess.
Well, we're led to believe that.
Yes, because they spouted off some ordinance. The cops spouted off some ordinance that this place was in violation of, like, lewd behavior.
Well, I think that's even the case in Chicago, where you can't have male dancers with their genitalia wanging around.
So it's because he actually exposed himself that that's where they got into trouble.
Yeah.
It's so, not so much that they were taking their clothes off to a certain degree. It was because he did flash his dick.
I think that's what the cops did. I think the stripping was okay, like down to your underwear is okay. But then as soon as he whipped out his dong, or lack thereof, that's when the cops pulled the badges out and cleared the bar, which I've been in a bar when it's been shut down before. It never happens that way. It's a nice orderly, the music starts to get quiet.
We're going to have to shut it down. Yep. Let's turn up the lights.
Finish your drinks quickly. Start moving towards the exits. Mm-hmm. The last thing the police want to do is like start yelling at a bunch of drunk gay people. They'll go crazy like Debbie did.
And Debbie went crazy because you see in the diner the next day, she has rallied the troops.
Yeah. And this just seemed to ramp up like really quick. She had a point, but just wasn't that realistic. Bars get temporarily closed all the time. They make mistakes.
But we get to the point of showing how Debbie is quite the leader in the community.
Yeah. Mysteriously.
Much to the chagrin of Michael.
Yeah.
Because even he's like defending Brian when she's attacking him. And I'm glad she made such a great big point of saying, who are you going to stand against? Who are you going to stand with, Michael? Your friends, your community, or him?
Well, I thought it was unusual for Michael to be the one telling Debbie that we're not going to stand up to Stockwell and fight back. It was another one of those cases where there were some decent lines, but given to the wrong character.
Because, mm-hmm, yeah, even Michael then has like this little aside with Brian and saying, you know what you're doing is shitty.
Just want you to know, I think what you're doing really sucks.
Oh, Christ. Not you, too.
But Stockwell's just stirring shit up.
As soon as he's elected, this law will blow over.
You think it's going to blow over for Ted?
Ted fucked up. It's not my problem.
Mom's right. You don't care about anybody but yourself.
Well, if I don't, who will?
He's like, I expect him to be like kicking rocks and sort of looking down. And mm-hmm. He's sort of like half scolding Brian for what he's doing with Stockwell. I'm like, Michael, you don't even care.
Well, let's not forget that Michael is the one that wouldn't even go to Pride.
Michael has got a lot of shit to work out himself.
I did like seeing Debbie and Vic together when they're strolling down the street. That was a nice little scene.
I'm just a fan of just whenever Debbie and Vic are on screen together. They get the, honestly, sometimes I think they get the best stuff.
Well, Debbie marches right into the police station.
Yes.
Did you notice when she's walking through that all the cops recognized her? They're all glaring at her. There's some really nice directing there. There's good blocking mm-hmm. and good casting on the extras to give those looks. It was nice.
And that gives a lot of heat to Horvath. Because I'm sure she has to have been around the precinct, has shown herself to be in a somewhat intimate manner with Horvath. I'm sure Horvath has talked about it. So now he's got heat going on him for his girlfriend. And there's that one cop who says she should have a muzzle. I'm like, ooh.
That's true.
Ooh.
I kind of have to side with Carl here. First of all, I've got 3 points. First of all, Debbie shouldn't have like gone to his workplace to have that conversation. And this is a bit of one of those times in life where you just need to keep your mouth shut and do your job. And that's what Horvath was kind of doing. There's very few moments in life where you can just walk out on your job based solely on morals and personal beliefs. It would be even harder for Carl to do that since there's only so many law enforcement agencies in Pittsburgh to choose from. This is his career and he doesn't necessarily have to like it, but he's doing his job. He's following the law. There wasn't really anything outside of the norm for what he had to do. And second, He didn't even shut the bar down. So what was his involvement in this? It was like two other cops.
I do see your point in that.
Wouldn't it have been better if he was the cop in the bar shutting it down instead of these other two hot cops?
Then we would understand the conflict. Yeah.
Maybe
here it's just because
Peter O'Neill wasn't available that day.
It seems that just because he is the representative of the cops that she is close to, that she feels that she can go after him. And because even just like, what did I do?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he does have something of a position of authority, I guess, but connection. Well, he's like a ranking detective there. He has an office.
Uh-huh.
But we don't have any connection to him being the manager of these two guys that shut down the bar. So
yeah, probably they could have been from a different precinct.
Yeah. And if he had been the one to shut down the bar, then all of his problems with carrying out his duty and being personally uncomfortable with it, some strife with his relationship with Debbie, it would have made sense.
And we have seen Horvath step up to the plate when it came to Ted's arrest. He got information, he got it to Debbie and said, like, this is what's going on. So he has proven himself to be helpful. But here, I think it's a point where like he's like, yeah, this is my boss. I don't know what I can do.
Right. But they break up. So next.
But I think that that speaks to where Debbie is able to go in terms of how much she sticks to her guns. So
even though they weren't even really pointed at Horvath. Just some weak writing, I'm afraid.
Yeah, there wasn't a way to really show how complicated a matter this was.
Still queer as folk.
So there's one story in this episode that was pretty clean, and that's Tad.
Poor Ted.
I'm concerned about Ted mixing alcohol and painkillers. People die from that.
Yeah,
he's just popping them back.
Well, yeah, this is the downward spiral for Ted. And I think this is that point where the show is going to start to get really tough to watch for me because of how much I love Ted.
Aw. Just remember, hon, he's not real.
You can still be attached to characters, Patrick, and feel for them. That's a sign of good acting and good writing.
But at the end of the day, when the credits roll,
I know, but I'm not going to apologize for feeling for a character. That's just a testament to what Scott Lowell and what the writers are actually giving one of the actors to work with.
Yeah, one of them.
One of them.
Two big things are back. The Q-Mart and Tracy.
And she's a manager.
Mr. Manager.
Ms. Manager.
I miss Bob Barbarossa from season one.
Who was the guy that got Michael's job that Michael also kissed?
Oh, what was that guy's name?
Was it an Andrew?
Andrew, yeah.
It was an Andrew?
Yeah.
I wonder what happened to him. Maybe he got transferred.
Something about Ted applying for a bookkeeper job fell really flat with me.
It wasn't even a bookkeeper. It was like an assistant bookkeeper.
It's for assistant bookkeeper. From the resume you sent me, you seem a little overqualified.
It doesn't matter. As I was just saying to Michael, there's no shame in earning an honest day's pay for an honest day's work.
Ted has an MBA from Wharton, which is one of the top business schools in the country. Surely he's built up a big network of contacts as a result, like Dale Wexler, for example.
Well, but even then, Dale Wexler seemed surprised to see Ted when they met.
Well, he seemed surprised that he was still at the same firm. But yes, he still recognized him. So Ted's lack of employment story here needed to be more firmly rooted in his dodgy porn past or being gay or something like that.
Yeah, seeing your face plastered on tabloids as some porn king, I'm surprised they hadn't continued to roll with that.
Well, it wasn't connected here. Mm-hmm. I guess we have to believe that, oh, he ran a porn site, nobody will hire him. Which I just don't believe because we're just left wondering why a qualified accountant can't find work because he ran a porn site.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
Maybe it did in 2003.
But there are ways to word your resume to where you don't have to say I ran jerkatwork.net.
Yeah, it just seems
like I was the founder and CEO of a successful website for, yeah, there are ways to go about it.
Well, and even if you're not going to lie on your resume, there's plenty of people that will hire people that have had problems in their past. Mm-hmm. I hire people like that all the time. They are generally some of the better workers because they have more at stake. And they're more thankful to have the job. And they work really, really hard.
Think one mistake could be the end, which is kind of a shame. Like, we like to think that folks have rehabilitated and they are just trying to move on with their lives. But we, as a society, tend to hang on to past mistakes, which is a shame.
I thought it was really unprofessional of Tracy not to call Ted directly, though, to break the news. Instead, she told Michael.
Well, come on. The suspense is killing me. I mean, did she talk to the district manager?
This really isn't the time
Michael,
or the place.
Michael, you know how much this means to me. Please don't play games.
I'm not playing games. She said he had someone else in mind for the job. Someone more qualified.
More qualified? She said I was overqualified as it is. Are you sure that was the reason?
That's all she told me. That's all I know.
Like, why would she tell Michael? He doesn't even work there anymore.
Right.
What?
And Michael and Tracy are in like that kind of contact. They're getting together to gossip.
Oh, yeah. They totally text at happy hour or something. Like, no, come on.
So this story was falling apart. So I tried to stick with this one.
Ted jumps on an opportunity to be a bartender for one of the parties that Emmett is hosting.
He had no choice.
And he's doing, I guess, I didn't think he had actually bartending skills. So, you know, good for him. But he meets an A-gay at this party. And at first I thought it was that A-gay that he was trying to impress. And I could not remember.
Garth Racine.
Garth. I'm sitting there like, is that him?
Oh, yeah.
Because in the IMDb page, he's just listed as A-gay, not Garth, which is why I was questioning it.
Yeah, I mean, he had to be there. This totally delivered on the sentiment of the scene because Ted's waiting on the head A-gay that he once aspired and emulated to be. And Garth was just so cutting and dismissive of Ted. I love that.
I know you. You're Schmidt. Ted, isn't it? The one with that website.
Hello, Garth.
Saw your picture in the paper and on the news. What a shame.
Yeah, well.
I like that.
Oof.
Garth is played by Dan Lett. He's a really great character actor. He was in only two episodes of Queer as Folk, but I really like his portrayal of Garth Racine in both of them.
Because I hated Garth so much in the first time. You loved him, but
I did.
I was not a fan.
I'm surprised that the writing team even remembered Garth, considering how many other memory lapses they've had.
Considering the continuity means jack shit in this series.
Yeah, it's like somebody thought, hey, let's bring back Garth Racine. Somebody thought of that.
Maybe when they were going through the recycled papers to find other storylines, they came across Garth and like, he'll do.
With some index card that fell off the board a long time ago. It's like, hey,
we found this under the couch.
We booked Dan Lett for two episodes. Let's bring him back and get our money's worth here.
There you go. But then this leads to this downward spiral for Ted.
And the next day, we see that Ted comes out of the bedroom at 1:10. Thank you, prop supervisor, because the clock was set to 1:10. And he goes right for a Bloody Mary. And I thought that was funny because I have never once been a hair of the dog type. I don't soothe too much drink with more drink. He goes right for the Bloody Mary.
There are instances, though, where a hangover can really only be cured by going after it with alcohol of a different ilk.
Oh, I don't know if I believe that.
It sounds crazy, but there's a reason why shower beers are a thing.
What?
Yeah.
Isn't that the night before?
No.
Oh.
Sometimes you wake up in the morning, you crack a Bud Light, and that gets you through the day.
What are you talking about?
Listen, my 20s were a very interesting time.
Well, yeah, if I wake up after having too much to drink the night before, I do not want to see, smell,
be anywhere near.
I want to find water, some tater tots. Say hi to the mailman coming over. That's it. So
I guess we all have our tricks.
Tricks. Okay.
And
this scene of Ted coming home drunk. Oh, Teddy. Oh, no.
And this, again, this is me speaking to the work that Scott Lowell is doing with this storyline. When he shoves Emmett and that immediate remorse.
Well, first,
an uncertainty.
It wasn't just that. Just leading up to that, he was like that perfect fall down drunk. That's
yeah.
Kind of holding it together, but pinballing off of everything in sight.
Yeah. This is a man on the verge of collapse.
Something I found unusual in this scene is that all of his best friends were there, right? They're all in the room. None of them made a move to contain him. They just kind of watched and were like, ooh. So I guess they might have been deferring to Emmett, but still, if I was there, I probably would have pitched in a little.
This is a very passive group of friends. They're all kind of waiting for someone else to do the work.
That just rang a little hollow to me. I get what Del Shores was going for there, which is to show that everybody's uncomfortable, to have Ted experience this downfall, mm-hmm. but they became just an audience to it and a disapproving audience.
And
I just would have done something.
And even after he shoves Emmett and all these things go flying off the counter, everyone just stares.
Yeah.
No one goes to like help clean up. No one goes to try and help Ted lie down. They all just kind of like, Emmett's got this. Yeah.
Party's over.
We'll get back to our empanadas.
Let's grab some leftovers. Mm-hmm.
Anybody got a container?
So this was nice. Nice writing to see this downfall start. I think the execution of it ended up being a little troublesome. Speaking of troublesome, Melanie. law.
Melanie, woman at law.
We learned earlier that Melanie is a partner in this firm. So it seemed a little odd to me that she's on the back foot here, because as a partner, she should be having more say in her responsibilities. But here she's positioned as being dominated by a man in the workplace.
Did you dream this day would ever come?
I was beginning to have my doubts. I can't wait to call the client and tell her.
You might also want to tell her I'll be taking over as lead counsel.
Excuse me?
You asked the firm to lighten your workload, so don't worry about it. Dee, Eric, we'll be reconvening in my office. We need to go over the briefing schedule, start mapping out our strategy.
Hold it. I spent the last 3 years of my life getting this case to court. It's going to be a landmark decision.
And it's also going to take your full and undivided attention from now until we go to trial. There's no way you can do all that's required and only work part-time.
She's a partner in this firm. Well,
and what? This is so early in her pregnancy, and they're talking about whether or not she can handle the workload.
Yeah, she's like in the first trimester, right?
That's like she's probably, what, 8 weeks pregnant?
Yeah.
Like, she's not even showing anything. And they're talking about how much workload she has and how she needs to cut back. What?
Yeah, this is just another example of the writing team not using a good rearview mirror on character arcs. It's like, first Melanie becomes victimized at work by the men, but she's a partner. She owns half the firm. Well, a third of the firm. So what? Come on.
And this battle that she's having with Lindsay.
Oh, that was good. I like that.
Oh, you like this. Okay.
I thought that was some really, really good writing because it showed a great lesbian family storytelling.
And well, it brings up a great point about the battle of trying to have it all. And I do like that. And I like what Mel is trying to get across, that I can be pregnant, I can still have a career, and I can still take care of my family. That is possible. So like, let me do it.
Well, she wasn't doing it though. That was the whole point. It seems like Melanie just should have more thoroughly thought through her pregnancy. So she gets pregnant mm-hmm. at this misopportune time where this very important case is coming up. And apparently she was demoted from partner.
But this is also the first time we've heard that this important case is in her hands.
Yeah.
If there had been that buildup.
I think there might have been mention of it a long time ago.
Oh, I feel like we would have touched on it if it had been mentioned before.
Well, either way, Melody doesn't really even know how the law works. In this case.
Right. She just knows law.
Yeah. Because she's talking about like witnesses and depositions and stuff like that. You don't do that on appeal. So she's basically talking about retrying an entire case. Whereas appeals are essentially reviews of what happened in the trial. It's not a retry of the case.
It's like Del Shores went on to dictionary.com and wrote law terms.
Yeah.
It's just copy-paste.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's a lack of detail on the writing team. It's just lazy. If mm-hmm. you want people to be a believable character, make it believable. It doesn't take you that long to figure out what is an appeal to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania.
What are the steps here?
Yes. It doesn't take you that long, and it's important.
No, it doesn't matter. Law, law, law,
law. La, 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 la. But I did like the scenes between Melanie and Lindsay when they're debating whose job was like more important. That was great. Ooh. When they went upstairs and awkward blocking when Melanie says, I have to take Gus to his bath, and then she walks right past the bathroom. Lindsay said that. It was only so that Melanie could come up the stairs behind her and start interrogating her.
And I'm never going to be the kind of mother you are.
What kind of mother's that?
The kind who's willing to give everything up to be with her kid 24/7.
Who asked you to be? The agreement was to share and share alike. But the first time it interferes with your work...
There is a way it doesn't have to.
You want me to quit my job?
No, of course not. But we could get a part-time nanny.
No, no, no. I was raised by nannies, in case you'd forgotten. I will not have Gus be raised by someone else. You know, for someone who's so intent on defending lesbian motherhood, you're not much of an example.
What the fuck is that supposed to mean? Straight mothers work full time and have nannies? What difference does it make?
The difference is we have to be a little bit better. I'm sure your clients would agree with me.
So is it A for effort, execution?
C. Well,
yeah. Good try. We had to fill in a lot with this story, but it's leading up to the next episode is really all as it is. And that's why it's a runner in this episode.
So yeah, so let's just get to episode 10. Maybe things will turn around for us.
Let's get to episode 1 of season 4 so we can put season 3 behind us.
And we're almost there, Patrick.
It's shaping up to be a train wreck.
Oof.
Season 2 kind of started hitting on all cylinders. Season 1 was all over the board, but really energetic.
It was interesting.
Yeah. Season 3 is lots of misses.
I think I've had a little more hits than misses from season 3. Because like I know like you also had a very strong opinion about Hunter entering the story, and I don't mind. So
can't get rid of that kid fast enough.
Oh, God.
So let's talk about the hits and misses in this episode. My hit was something we were just talking about. The scene with Lindsay and Melanie arguing about responsibilities to their son, to their family. That's a hit for me. It was thoughtful writing and told a very real story. And secondarily, it's always a win to see good writing for the lesbians.
He's right, because either they're hardly in the episode or they get an incredibly graphic sex scene.
Right.
And that's about it.
It had holes in it. It fell apart. If you suspend disbelief, it's good. A close second on my hit was Ted's drunken scene. Really like that. I kind of laughed at it. I love that.
I know. I got like a little emotional. Like I was feeling for Ted. My hit was Deb's big mouth calling out Michael, because it was bugging me to no end that everyone in that diner was ready to jump on Brian and Michael is trying to defend him in some way. And Deb's like, hold the fuck up.
Oh, so did Ben.
and Ben too. And I was like, yes, Debbie and Ben. That's great. And I'm glad, because that's something that Michael needed to hear. It's like, guess what? The world does not shine out of Brian's ass as much as you fucking wanted to.
So, something else about Debbie that I liked was when she is in Woody's doing shots and Michael comes up and says, don't interrupt me. I'm concentrating. And she's just throwing back shots.
Mother I'm telling is you, I would go to any event that she hosted. She would be amazing.
Yeah.
She's a great MC. I'm surprised I didn't think about that earlier.
My miss was just more antipathy from Michael about Brian and Justin. It just grates on me because it never ends and mm-hmm. it needs to.
Dear God, find something else to do with Michael.
Yeah.
So my miss is, so this is not a knock on how Scott Lowell is portraying it, but it's just how we got to Ted's descent into disaster.
It was quick.
It was quick. It feels like it's being blamed on Emmett for being successful.
Oh, you think so?
I do, because we got a hint of it in the last episode when Emmett had an amazing, successful gallery opening at Lindsay's art gallery. Ted was sort of relegated to being the secondary role, and that seemed to have some sort of psychological effect on him. And I feel like that is carrying through that his downfall.
That was his tipping point.
Yeah, and that But it doesn't make sense to me when he was ready to do so much just for Emmett. That wouldn't he be happy that Emmett is being successful, that Emmett is doing what he was clearly loves to do and is proud to do? Wouldn't he be proud of him for getting to where he is today? And I think that's the thing I'm having trouble with. So it's more on the writing, not so much on Scott Lowell's portrayal, because him, that drunk scene was hard to watch in the best way. Like I'm seeing an actor who like dug deep to get there, and it was good. Good work.
So this has been episode 9 of season 3. Big fucking mouth.
Next time, Brian and Justin are at odds over his work with Stockwell. Well, what else is new?
Ted goes away for the weekend and meets new friends.
Oh no. Mel becomes annoyed by Michael's constant concern.
That will be episode 10 of season 3, and it's called Uncle Ben. I don't know why.
We're on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF, and you can find us on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
I'm on Instagram at Patrick Randall.
And I'm on Twitter and Instagram at MatthewPD.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed your time with us, please subscribe so that we can keep making shows for you. Until next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me. Still Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.
Still Queer as Folk.